The Tom Hanks Crown Affair, in honor of Larry Crown, the feel-good summer release starring Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts opening this weekend, what's the most egregious example of a good cast in an otherwise uninteresting movie?
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with Ocean's 12, because the first one was so good, and what a stellar cast, and then the second one, oh my god, what happened?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with another Matt Damon movie hereafter, because it disproves my theory that Matt Damon could do no wrong, and I really resent it for that.
Multiple offender.
I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going to go with Ben Affleck's, not to give him the possessive, but he's just not that into you because it's one of the most vile movies I can ever remember seeing, and it stars about 40% of every famous person currently living,
and
all famous people.
I'm Dave with the 7, not one of the famous people that was in He's Just Not That Into You, and I was going to say Valentine's Day, but thinking about it, I'm going to go with Jay and Silent Bob's Strike Back, which has an amazing amount of cameos that it manages to do nothing with.
There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
It's a podcast.
Hey, welcome back to this week's Operation Kino. We've got a big show full of more shouting about blockbusters, which I know is what you always...
It's kind of what we're all about.
It's what we're all about, at least this summer.
We're new. This is the only thing we've done. The fall is going to be really nice, quiet conversations with port
and
cigars.
But it looks as if our tidbit section is filled with love.
So the shouting is going to start when we review Transformers Dark of the Moon, which is it's already out in theaters now as we record this. And we're going to spring off from there, actually, to talk about the films of the year so far that we've loved the most. And spoiler alert, someone might have Transformers on that list. We'll see how things go. But we're going to start with tidbits first, which is, as David said, filled with love. Patches, you're up first.
Yeah, so as people who have listened to this podcast multiple times may remember, I've been going each week in the past 3 weeks to go see the Lord of the Rings extended editions in theater, pristine, I think they're Blu-ray projections, essentially, but the first time that I've ever seen Lord of the Rings back in theaters since I saw them theatrically, and the first time I've ever seen the extended editions in theaters. And I have to say, you know, coming off of all these big summer blockbusters that we've been seeing that are just kind of messy, flung up there, you so many cooks in the kitchen kind of thing, Lord of the Rings, yeah, going back to them in theaters, this epic presentation of the movies, there will never be a movie like Lord of the Rings ever again. And I just want to profess my love for a moment. And now that the Blu-rays are actually coming out, are they out right now? I'm not sure.
I was just going to ask you when they come out.
I think they are out now.
You can order them on Amazon, extended edition Blu-rays. And first off, they look amazing. I don't know if they've heightened the colors or actually changed them in any way, but I mean, the photography is extraordinary. It's unbelievable. I chalk it up to New Zealand being such an extravagant country and this beautiful landscape, but also the way these films are crafted. You just don't see the kind of investment put into these movies, into big action movies and storytelling.
I feel like I'm ready to cry.
I was crying in theaters. I mean, it's unbelievable compared
to
all these movies I've been seeing.
Return of the King gets you. Is it Return of the King that made you cry?
Well, I just saw Return of the King last year. No one bows to you, my friends. Actually, the best line is Shadowfax, let's define haste. I believe Gandalf says, and
I can't carry the ring, but I can carry you.
But I've learned multiple things from rewatching Lord of the Rings, and I would beg you to go back and rewatch all of them, almost marathoning, but maybe not quite. You need bathroom breaks. But when I saw them theatrically, I loved Fellowship. I thought Two Towers was okay, and then Return of the King was a great cap. You know, one big story. Going back, extended editions, Two Towers is an extraordinary film. If you've ever wondered how a true epic film can be paced going back and forth between storylines, it is a masterpiece. It is truly a masterpiece. And what I think sets Lord of the Rings apart from all these other blockbusters and these big epic films is Peter Jackson, you know, there's these big action scenes, lots of sworded sandals, fighting, horsebacks. But at the end of the day, it's about these characters that we followed kind of in close-up, and that's how he shoots them too. Even in these big moments, it's all about Aragorn, or it's all about Frodo, and they're up there in their faces, and it's just a different way of filmmaking, and it's so naturalistic, even in this fantasy environment. God, it's just a different way of making movies that no one does, and to have shot them all in a row in one big swoop, it's unmatchable. I don't think anyone will ever make movies like this again.
Does it make you more or less excited for The Hobbit?
It makes me curious about The Hobbit. I don't know. I wonder if they can achieve the same magic. I hope they can. I think they can. The same team, everyone's back for those movies. But, I mean, what a capsule of just being handed a wad of cash and go and make your vision because it's that extraordinary. It's that convincing. And no one can do that. I don't see filmmakers out there, even post Lord of the Rings, if Peter Jackson doesn't have that same vision anymore. It's impossible. The source material is too great, too detailed, and it's an extraordinary film experience. And to sit through it all, I would highly recommend going back to the Blu-rays and kind of just indulging in the whole thing all at once.
I'm surprised that you haven't had more, I don't know, forced, I don't want to say access, but forced viewing of these films over the past however many years, because I think I've seen each of them roughly 7 or 8 million times.
All at once, though. Like, I'll watch snippets of Fellowship, Two Towers I didn't touch since theatrical, and then Return of the King maybe I'll catch, like, parts of. It's, again, it's like sitting down and really letting them wash over you. It's you don't really sit down and watch them, I think. You just kind of, like, put them on.
I will say that the Two Towers, the extended edition is really corrective. I agree with you that it's a wonderfully epic film in its longest incarnation, but it is by far, in my estimation, the weakest of the theatrical cuts.
Maybe the theatrical cuts, but the extended
I'm speaking explicitly about the theatrical cuts. And while I do think that the worst part of the franchise in its entirety are the Ents, which are obviously featured prominently in the Two Towers.
What do you mean?
The Two Towers is completed. It's completely made by the more prominent role of Faramir in the extended editions, and
sure,
he is a ghost in the theatrical cut. And
so
the movie,
basically, what I would end up saying is, like, in this sea of blockbusters that we're seeing this summer that are hit or miss, Lord of the Rings, no matter what, go back to them. They're a test of time. Like, they are the way to make these kind of movies. That's what I would say.
That sounds amazing.
You make me want to get the Blu-ray. I will. You know, I think I have Return of the King on DVD, but I clearly need to beef it up. I have the opposite of an epic tidbit, and it's about the opposite of epic thing. That's about Twitter, specifically about the Twitter feed of R.L. Stein, the author of the scary children's books, Goosebumps, and also the teen-focused scary books, Fear Street. Which apparently I am
completely unfamiliar with Fear Street.
You have so much catching up to do.
Did that pass? I mean, was that my time? I don't even
know. I mean, I read them when I was way too young. They're all about, like, teenagers killing each other.
Oh.
Called, like, the prom.
Oh, wow.
And stuff like that. Dave, I believe you have a special attachment to R.L. Stein.
Yes, I have a large collection of the original Goosebumps that I hold on to dearly. And got to tweeting at him a few times because I wanted to get them all signed. And then he started ignoring me.
Oh, God.
Well, R.L. Stein has a Twitter feed. I've been following him for about a year, and I find it enjoyable to follow him on a general basis because he has this campaign, like, where every now and then he'll say, "Have you scared a child today?" And he'll constantly tweet, like, scary real-life stories about, like, bugs crawling out of people's ears or, like, infestation.
Yeah, that's what I like about his feed, that it's not constant self-promotion. He's like tweeting news stories about horrific things happening to people. He's continuing to scare me even in my 20s.
He adopts scaring people as this kind of, like, jovial traditional thing, and even though I don't like horror, I really like that attitude toward scaring people, especially children. And Patches, a couple days ago, as I told you, you broke the fourth wall of my childhood.
Yes.
Do you want to explain how this happened?
Yes. I've been trying to read more short stories recently, and since I follow R.L. Stein on Twitter, I thought I would ask him, because I didn't know offhand, if he had written short stories or short story collections. And I guess I mentioned in my tweet to him, yeah, I guess this is the kind of thing I could just look up on Wikipedia. But why not, with the amazing power of Twitter, just ask R.L. Stein if he's written short stories? And lo and behold, I mean, he got back to me within, what, like 2 minutes
of me
asking the question with the names of books. And I'm pretty sure that he runs his own account based on just kind of the weird shit that he's always tweeting. But it's the power of Twitter there, like the communication between you and these people who, you know, when I was a kid talking to R.L. Stein, it's like talking to God.
You'd have, like, waited 8 hours to have your book signed by R.L. Stein, and now you can just
right.
tweet him, and I love that.
If we ever reach a place in this world where R.L. Stein can no longer run his own Twitter feed,
the man has many followers, so I was very gracious to receive an answer from R.L. Stein.
And there are, you know, I follow various famous people on Twitter. Twitter, and there's not very many of them who I would, like, if one of my friends got a response from them, I'd freak out, but Arl Stein is definitely one of them. So, everyone,
so highly recommend following him.
I should have done this before this. I need to look up the actual address of his Twitter feed. Does anyone know it offhand?
Nope. I think it's at Arl Stein.
I think there might be an underscore in there. I'm going to type that through. Yeah, it's RL underscore Stein, STINE.
Yes.
And, yes, please revisit your childhood by following him on Twitter.
Quite amusing.
Quite amusing. David is up next.
Yes, ma'am. I'm actually going to be full of love this week, not to spoil anything to come. But I was in my local Jazz Mart one afternoon, as I do.
Explain what Jazz Mart is.
It's a Japanese mart. You know, it's where you go and you buy your green tea and your rice triangles for lunch.
Who does that, I guess.
Right. If by you, I mean me. they sell DVDs there, often bootlegs, or maybe a half step up from bootlegs. And sitting there on the English subtitled row was, to my pleasant surprise, a copy of a DVD of Studio Ghibli's newest film, The Borrowers, which is Studio Ghibli being sort of the Pixar equivalent of Japan, but of course predated Pixar, and Hayao Miyazaki is sort of their John Lasseter and is someone whom John Lasseter worships. And The Borrowers is co-written by Miyazaki. It's an adaptation of the classic children's novel that Miyazaki has been trying to make for years and years. And there was a John Goodman film of some kind in the 90s.
Yes, I sent you the trailer for that.
Yeah,
it's hilarious.
I've read the book. I've seen the movie, but I have no recollection of either. And that was a lifetime ago. But I immediately snagged this DVD up for $9.99, trusting that subtitles would be – yeah, it was great. Especially because the Blu-ray is like $80 to import. And so I thought it was a steal, and I ran home and watched it. And I was so, especially in the wake of Cars 2, which was such a depressing nadir of Pixar's quality. I was so enchanted and delighted with The Borrowers, which is going to be coming out in American theaters in a dubbed version with Will Arnett and Amy Poehler and some other people next February, I believe.
Their dubs
are fine, but I'm a bit.
I mean, Disney does a good job with them.
Yeah, they do. They certainly do a above par job. But I'm a bit of a purist, and so it wasn't a choice for me. I didn't have the option of watching it dubbed, but I was so delighted with this movie. I think it is short and sweet. It is about these very 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 little people, and I don't mean like little people. I mean like people who are about 5 to 6 inches tall.
They sleep in shoes or something.
They sleep in shoes. It's so cute and crazy. And they live in the...
It sounds so Japanese.
Well, this adaptation of it is set in a suburb of Tokyo. But they live in a cellar of a family's house. They live a secret existence. There are very, very few of them. And, you know, it's a mother and a father and their teenage daughter, who's like 12 or 13, and it's on the cusp of being a teenager, who's getting beginning to get a little bit restless and wanting to know more of her world and explore. And it's very a Little Mermaid, and that she makes contact with I guess she doesn't transform, but she makes contact with a very ill, potentially terminally ill young boy who's moved into this house recently. And it's just, it's a very...
Does it stand up to some of their... I mean, I'm a big fan of Spirited Away and Princess Mononoke, mm-hmm. and even, like Howl's Moving Castle. But and they have a lot... They go deep. I mean, they can be very emotional films.
I think this is actually the purest... I mean, Studio Ghibli has a long track record of having very environmentally focused films. Their films are, if you had to sort of distill them into one overriding theme, very much about the place of humanity in the world. The place of our species in the world and how we coexist with the world around us and sort of the narcissism we have as sort of being the superior species, the dominant species on this planet. And this is their most concise and direct exploration of that theme and sort of the dynamic between the borrowers and the humans who live in the house. And it's very frank and it's very blunt. It's not a particularly dark story, I'd say, but it is very courageously forward in what might happen to these characters after the film, I'd say. The animation is stunning. It's probably Studio Ghibli's best. It's 2D, gorgeous animation. It's so tactile and real. The sound design is impeccable. It's the most kinetically involving animation I've seen since Ratatouille. I mean, there are scenes where she's climbing chairs, you know, with like things, little household items that she's fashioned into pickaxes, like she's climbing the side of a mountain. And it's so exciting to watch. It's so rich. The score, which is by a French composer, it's very glassy, lots of sort of hollowed out sounds, is beautiful. I think this isn't saying too much, unfortunately, because Studio Ghibli's golden age was really in the 90s. But this is, in my estimation, the best Studio Ghibli film since Spirited Away in 2001.
Wow.
It's by a first-time filmmaker named Hiromasu Yonebayashi, who does a lovely job. Keep an eye out for this movie when it comes out next February. It is incredibly pleasant and thought-provoking and resonant 90 minutes, and I cannot recommend it highly enough, and was such a perfect antidote to Cars 2.
Lovely. It sounds not to editorialize, but it sounds like an antidote to Transformers 3 as well.
But we'll get to that later.
Shut up, Katie.
Everything I know. Okay, we'll get there later. Dave, you're going to take us to television for a second.
I am going to take us to television, but I'm also bookending the tidbits like patches, suggesting that maybe the better thing to do is to revisit the past instead of stay in the future. But really quickly, summer TV season sort of kicked off. If you're a television addict like me, or if you work in television like me, you watch a lot of TV and sort of get invested in things. And I felt sad saying goodbye to all the characters in the spring and then seeing them later in the fall. But I picked up some summer TV. I picked up True Blood on HBO, which is back in its fourth season. It has a lot to do with fairies.
Wait, they have fairies?
Yes. It was revealed that Sookie was a fairy in season three. And in the first 10 minutes that they put online, they take her to the fairy world, and they're fairy, like, energy grenades.
What the hell?
True Blood is going completely off the rails.
I've seen one episode from the first season, so this is kind of blowing my mind.
I think you could defend True Blood in a similar fashion as to how I'm about to defend Transformers, but I fucking loathe True Blood. I think it's one of the very worst shows I've ever seen in my 26 years of being on.
I think if it didn't air in the summer, it would have not made it through season one entirely. But
that's an interesting theory.
We'll keep going through. Falling Skies, which I've talked about in the premiere, and Patch has also talked about.
I just got the rest of the episode, so I'm looking forward to finishing that, because I like the beginning.
Yeah, it's settling in and probably it will get a season two at this point. It did good enough numbers, and it looks like they're going to try to lock it in, if nothing else, anticipation for Spielberg's other series to come in later in the fall. What is it? We're going to keep going. Treme on HBO is back for season two. It's another David Simon sort of character of a city piece.
From The Wire.
The Wire people. This is New Orleans post-Katrina. Immediately post-Katrina was last season. This season they start weaving the characters closer together in the city and sort of bringing those two things close together. And it's just really good character work.
What's the through line there? Because I know a lot of people who are just telling me, oh, they just kind of play a lot of jazz and every once in a while they're crying about something.
It's sort of, I would compare it not so much to The Wire as I would compare it to Six Feet Under, where it's this group of characters and you just see how they progress linearly through time and how they end up touching each other's lives, whether or not they're aware of it. Is how the second season has sort of been playing out from my perspective. Its finale, I believe, is this Sunday.
Does the show entertain you, or do you find it to be sort of a chore to get through? I've heard mixed things.
It's hard to start. Like, it's almost hard to start each episode to, like, sit down and get back into this world, but it's very satisfying at the end of each episode and at the end of each season. So it's sort of a slog to start each episode, but they've all been very rewarding, almost across the board. And then the other one is Louie on FX, came back for season two, and it looks like...
I am Operation Kino Trivia here. Whenever you see the stand-up bits of Louie season two, my face is in his balls.
They recorded many, many
They only, as far as I know, there are only two.
Well, no, there's multiple.
Multiple, because I have
insiders on the inside of Louie.
I saw him do about 2.5 hours of stand-up, and I I decided deliberately to sit in the front row where I would not be in range of the cameras because my face is nothing that this country needs to see every Thursday night on FX. But if you hear it particularly... No, but if I'm right off camera. But if you...
But actually, I think most people would be going... watching the show for Louis as opposed to David.
Well, I mean, it's also Louis produces...
I was just going to say, just to keep an ear out, because if you're a particularly noxious laugh...
David, you are wasting a minute of my tidbit time. Sit down.
Or
sit down. Louis came back, and it's building on its critical audience, I think, and it's actually going further than it is. It's one of those shows where Louis writes it, directs it, stars in it, and edits it. So he has a lot of creative control, and because of that, he brings it in a very low price. He could do whatever he wants, so it's a very challenging show, but if you like Louis C.K.'s humor, it is hilarious.
My conclusion is,
the best thing that you can be watching this summer in terms of TV is Netflix Instant is streaming the complete Larry Sanders Show, which has been so difficult to find in any sort of home video format, and it's all there. It's all up there. It's an HBO show that's a predecessor to Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's a... behind the show, sort of reality-based comedy. Anyway, it's awesome. You should just go check it out right now. I don't need to pitch it for you. But
so
that is
TV.
I do
want to
say that my face and Louis Balls notwithstanding, I think that is far and away the best show on TV right now.
Wow.
Bam.
I saw him on The Daily Show last night, and that was, I mean, that 4 minutes was probably the best thing I've seen on TV.
He talks about farts.
But it's dramatically interesting. I love that show so much.
So yeah, that's some Dave, summer TV suggestions.
Dave, that's history's probably most ambitious tidbit. You covered a lot of ground there.
So much.
All right. Well, before we get into our review of Transformers 3, we have a winner of Transformers toys. It's very exciting that we have some defenders of the movie because I was afraid we'd be giving away these toys and all just ragging on the movie. But
is it me?
See.
Did I win?
David. There's an Optimus Prime set of 3D glasses out there that probably can be yours if you ask nicely. But not this set, because this set is going to...
It involves... It's pertinent. Vaguely pertinent.
Before we get into your dreams, I'm going to give away these toys. He entered our contest, commenting as Apocalypse Now and Later. Twitter name is Jeremy the Solly, S-O-L-L-I-E. So if you are Jeremy the Solly, please DM the Opkino Twitter account with your shipping information, and we will get you the box. It won't be within the next week.
So many toys.
Shipped next week. So be patient, but there's a ton of toys in it, and it's very exciting. We're glad to have our contest.
You should all follow the Opkino Twitter account at OPKINO, because that's how we get your information to give you things.
That's true. And not to steal it or do anything with it. David, do you really want to talk about your dream before we move on?
Only briefly.
I would prefer if we didn't talk about David's dream.
It involves Dave giving away stuff.
No.
I had a dream last night that Dave was hosting a game show, and he asked me a question about Venus and Furs to win $500,000, and I got it, and then I instantly woke up, and I've been really mad at Dave all day.
For Dave for not having the $500,000 to give you.
Exactly.
Stupid dream, Dave.
That is truly disappointing.
Get ready to discover the secret of the things that go missing.
Something is taking our stuff.
And the wonderful world where you'll find them.
Gotcha. We're borrowers, and you're our bean. Beans provide you with things to borrow.
From the author of Bed Knobs and Broomsticks.
Those little rats stole something from me, and nobody steals from Otter.
Comes the magical tale of the borrowers.
I hate you little people.
Well, that's a shame, because we love you.
All right, so Transformers.
Yeah, speaking of pointlessness and dreams that go nowhere, Transformers 3.
Well, the thing that I enjoy about Transformers 3 is immediately after the screening, we all were at the same screening, which almost never happens. We were all there. Every movie critic in New York was there. There was only one screening, and it inspired the most hilarious, inventive, you know, rage-filled, imagination-filled conversation after the screening that I've seen in a really long time.
My blood is already boiling.
I know. There were so many opinions flying around. So many people were so engaged with it. And that makes me like it better than Transformers 2 on its own. Because Transformers 2, I think, just inspired a lot of head shaking and people just really wanting to wash their hands of it.
Except for me.
Well, okay, fine. If you want to get into your defense of Transformers 2,
No, we are not talking about that film.
I actually haven't reviewed Transformers 3. My general stance is I think there's a ton of problems with it. It's the first hour and a half really significantly dragged, but then you get into this giant action scene for the last hour. And
can you please try and describe what Transformers 3 is about before we dive in? I think it's important for you to try.
Wait. Why is it important for her to try?
God, let's not go there. But
I think
to give people a little context,
this movie has already made all the promises that it's going to make to this audience.
Give the people who haven't seen it yet a little context here.
So basically, really what you need to know, Shiloh's character is growing up. He's trying to get a job. He saved the world twice, but he can't tell anyone about it for some reason. And then they discover on the moon an Autobot named Sentinel Prime, who's voiced by Leonard Nimoy. And he holds the secret pillars that can rebuild Cybertron.
This is why you didn't like the movie.
Well,
okay,
no, no,
1969, the entire reason that humans have gone to the moon is because there's been an Autobot crash on the moon. That's how the movie starts. We pick up with Sam Witwicky, who's completely unimportant.
Is the main character, all the same.
Yes.
So they bring Leonard Nimoy back, and then the Decepticons, Megatron is still around. He's plotting to bring all of the Decepticons from Cybertron onto Earth so they can resettle it and have it be their home. For whatever reason, everyone winds up in Chicago, the Decepticons destroy it, and then we have to take it back. And that's pretty much what you need to know, I'd say. Yeah?
Very
and then there's a bunch of human characters who fit in at some point, but their plots aren't as important.
Human is a bit of a stretch.
Yes.
are you knocking Frances McDormand right
no,
now?
No. I mean, I didn't mean that as a detraction against, you know, my enjoyment of the film. I'm just saying that they were sketches of, you know, the creatures we know as humans.
That's fair.
So, Katie, as our middle ground person here.
Yeah, well, basically, I have a pretty short thing to say before I let you guys go at it. I had as many problems with that plot as you could probably expect from a plot that sounds like that, but I did find enough things to enjoy, and then I was sufficiently dazzled by the final action sequence to kind of walk out feeling energetic, although then I later realized how much of it I had sat kind of bored and restless and wondering how he could get away with so many gaping plot holes. But I do think I think Michael Bay's got this incredible talent for directing action scenes, and it's exhausting to go through all of them, but it's also incredibly impressive. And I think
how can it be both of those? That's what I'm curious about. So you found the film exhausting, but you also thought it was impressive?
Well, imagine being given something really delicious and you keep eating it. It's like gorging yourself on something that's incredibly well made.
I would make the comparison to Peter Jackson's King Kong, which I found exhausting but very impressive.
I would never argue this is as good as any of the Lord of the Rings movies, but in a way, those are also exhausting, especially if you watch them all back to back, because there's so much going into them. And Transformers is especially exhausting because it's so much going on. There's so little effort to modulate it, and all of the action is starting at the end, which I think is a problem with it, but it's very well made, and I appreciate that. That's my bit. Patches, you disagree with most of what I said, I think.
Oh, so everything. Transformers 3, and, you know, many people will praise it, including Dave and David, who will go after me. But it's... And you'll hear a lot of this, too. It's not as bad as the second one. The second one is probably the worst movie I've ever seen in my entire life. So saying it's better than the second one is kind of a moot statement. It's pointless. Transformers 3 Dark of the Moon is a bad film. It's a very bad film. It's incoherent. It's void of any emotion. And while we'll probably get into this a little bit more, you know, the plot... I don't need the plot to matter every time. I like big action movies. In fact, I've liked big action movies that Michael Bay has made in the past that really don't have coherent plots, like Armageddon or The Rock or all these other movies that he's made that, you know, it's about his shooting this action. But unfortunately, whereas Katie finds the action to be impressive while being exhausting, I find it just to be exhausting and not impressive in the slightest bit. It's not engaging in any way. You know, he's able to construct these incredible scenes with ILM, the CG artists behind him, and put all these robots doing amazing things. But at the end of the day, it's lifeless, it's soulless, it's not engaging. So even though you can construct it, it's pointless, and there's nothing gripping about it. Whereas Lord of the Rings, maybe you find that exhausting in some capacity. That movie is constructed with scenes that flow back and forth between wide, big shots and crazy action. And characters, like I said in our tidbits segment, it's just as much about the people you're engaging with as much as the big picture. And there's none of that in Transformers, and there never will be. You know, the robots are not characters. They're just entities that are there to bash each other. I can never tell any of them apart. And all the
Optimus
human characters.
Prime is the one who at the end.
Yes,
of every movie
yes,
says,
I know.
They could be a great people if they wish.
Yes,
to be.
Optimus gets
That's
his ass kicked
know.
Every movie and then comes back and does something amazing. I get it. It's the third one. You know, I know what to expect by this point, and I'm amazed that people can find enjoyment in it. And congratulations to the people who can. I just, for me personally, there's nothing to attach myself to. And while I understand that some people could take pleasure in the cacophony of destruction and the insane action that Michael Bay is able to paint, I think it's incoherent. I think he has no geography in creating action scenes. As I said, there's nothing to latch onto. And, you know, David mentioned to me after we saw the movie that he started comparing it to experimental film, which is a filmmaker by the name of Stan Brakhage, he used to paint splatters of colors on slides and let them rip. And it was about the spontaneity, about the chaos that he created. But the difference there is that not that there needs to be a narrative, and this movie has none, so don't worry about that. And many movies don't. You know, Tree of Life is kind of the same way. I hate to use Tree of Life and Transformers 3 in the same sentence. But these films don't have narratives, but what they do have is storytelling and consciousness about what they're putting on screen. And I don't think Michael Bay has any restraint. I don't think he has an understanding of what he throws out there. He shotgun effects everything. It's, if I can pile more on your plate, then you will somehow get engaged in it. And to be fair, there's in Transformers 3, there's one scene that I think is thrilling, and that's when it pulls back the most and focuses on the humans. And everything else is just mind-numbing, exhausting, boring.
I do want to say that as far as the Stan Brakhage comparison is concerned, beyond the aesthetic of it, why I found it so apt is because Stan Brakhage was at least partially a structuralist. And the films that he was showing were regurgitation of film itself. They were the literal components of film. I'm talking about like celluloid on celluloid action here. And I think that this film is, as I'll go into in a moment, very self-reflective about the state of blockbuster filmmaking in much the same way that structuralist films were literally about film.
Now, David, I basically want you to expand on that, since I think that's the central thesis of your defense of it, is that it's not just a blockbuster film, but a comment on them and an attempt to bring them to a level that they haven't been on before.
Well, I mean, before I begin, I want to make it clear that my appreciation of this film is not motivated by provocation. I have felt like sort of the Armand White of the blogosphere, or our small circle of the blogosphere, this summer.
Those of us yelling on the street outside the Times Square Theater.
Right, or the Armand very white, as anyone who has seen the tone of my skin would say. And that's a lovely bonus, for sure, but my opinion is sincere. I've enjoyed, especially The Rock, which is, I think, something of a masterpiece. I loathed the first Transformers. I mean, I thought that it was offensive. And the second one, I think I was very much in line with what everyone else had to say about it. But I think that this film is a masterpiece. I think it's one of the best films of the year. I think it's the ultimate comment. It's not only the ultimate sort of summer blockbuster, but I mean that in more ways than one. I mean, it's a summation of what blockbuster filming has come to represent. And it's in its portrait of excess, a amazing reflection of our national character. I mean, the way that this movie conflates Hasbro history with American history, just to begin with, sort of claiming the latter as a trophy for its mantle, as like another casualty of its carnage, is amazing. I mean, it's the ego of this film. It has a cameo in it that I think is incredibly pertinent to this discussion, but I think is more precious to the film than the cameo was in X-Men, which people were so guarded about, and people are so willy-nilly about this cameo. It sort of rubbed me the wrong way, so I won't mention it. But it's such a brilliant cameo because it introduces a character that we know from actual American history and has him sort of forfeit our own history to the world that Michael Bay has created.
I feel like you're just opportunistic.
I feel like you're laughing at the movie now. You're not enjoying the movie itself. You're laughing at it, some sort of like meta version.
I'm not laughing at it at all. I mean, and I think that it's important to understand that, self-aware or not, and I do think that Michael Bay is brilliant in his own regard, that whether or not the movie intends for any of the things that I take away from it is completely unintentional. It's completely irrelevant to me. I mean, I'm very much subscribed to the theory that art is in the eye of its beholder, and everything that I'm going to be espousing here, I took away sincerely from the film. I mean, I'm not mocking it for these decisions. I mean, I think that it is, and we'll get to sort of the aesthetic of it and the action, which everybody wants to talk about. But there are so many little things that speak to my reading of the film and how the stars. I mean, there's a whole Coen Brothers movie cast in this between John Malkovich and Frances McDormand,
which
and
I do
John
find
Turturro
delightful.
Has been in all the films. And I mean, yes, Michael Bay would happily just pilfer from the Coen Brothers as long as he could, but the fact that there are stars of all stripes in this movie is just part of its image, and that it's sort of saying to me, it says that blockbuster filmmaking of this scope is too magnetic. It's too irresistible to avoid, regardless of professional integrity, and that it will bring people in under the guise of money and the ability to ham it up and just like suck anything into it, sort of like the giant transformer from the second one on the pyramid that had the giant suction cup. But, I think I really just want to point everyone to Andrew O'Hare's Salon review, and not because it goes out of its way to quote me, but because I agree with it pretty much verbatim, and it is much more eloquent in writing than I could be in spoken word. But I do think that this is – he calls it sort of a Wagnerian masterpiece of excess, and I think that it really is. I mean, this movie is so over the top. It is such a disregard for logic or continuity that it's not only the biggest blockbuster on record – it's every blockbuster. It devours our massive pop culture into this one mess of a spectacle that I think to criticize for its plot or its characters would be like to watch a surrealist film like L'Âge d'Or or Un Chien Andalou and complain that there is no story there. I mean,
that's what I was trying to explain earlier, that the difference here is that those films, while they don't rely heavily on obvious narrative, that those are calculated films. They're art. I mean, they're artfully made.
I think the difference
they have
is
an eye to them. And Michael Bay just kind of, I don't get the sense that he cares about the things that he's putting in front of us as much as he's just piling them on.
I think that
I'm not that
is not the case. Nor do I think that it matters. I mean, I think that the surrealist objective was simply to provide a counterpoint to everything that was sort of a bourgeois institution. Everything that people boxed cinema into, you know, all the rules that they simply decided must be the rules of continuity and the rules of character and what was decent. Surrealists set out to destroy, and I've been really disenchanted by the critical reaction of this film because it's been seen in such a small box. I mean, I think people are – it has to be because it's in this package of being a blockbuster, you know, for the masses, that it has to hit these plot points and go from A to B. And if it doesn't satisfy those requirements, then people are frustrated with the movie. But I hated the first two so much, which that I think it worked as sort of an advantage for this film because I came in already understanding the tone and timbre the film was going to take. And from the moment it began, it was just working at a higher level. It was just a touch more lucid than the previous films had been to find that magic sweet spot but not only visually lucid, but also so incoherent narratively, even aggressively more so than the second one was. Only coherent.
Oh, I disagree with that. I think the second one was far more incoherent.
But the second one was a journey from sort of point A to point B, like geographically. And this one is, it has so many things that it's doing. It has so many balls in the air. But it's so much a comment of itself, of course, when it's talking about how it replaced Megan Fox. It's very self-reflexive in that way. But I think
it doesn't do that.
I mean, I think essentially what Michael Bay has done here is given a big fuck you to the established rules of blockbuster filmmaking. He's reclaimed the format for his own, in his own excess. I mean, I don't necessarily enjoy his sense of humor. Well, I think it's very juvenile, but I don't appreciate a lot of the things that he's done, but he's made it all his own. He obliterates the line between what our eye knows to be faked and what our brain tells us to believe in a way that I haven't seen since Fitzcarraldo, when Herzog insisted that they actually pull a boat over a mountain. When they have that scene towards the end of this film with the guys jumping out of the plane, soaring in 3D through the skyscrapers of downtown Chicago as the robots fight around them, which is obviously something that was not diegetically present.
We're 2 hours in and it's bored me to death by then.
I was transfixed. There's a tactile energy to all the special effects that felt very palpable and real. He composes his frames visually in a way that I've never seen a filmmaker keep in mind to. I mean, he'll put the camera on the ground and point it upwards, and he'll have several planes of concurrent action, often actual planes filling those levels, and it works very lucidly and clearly. I honestly think this is in a summer where you get complete generic hack work, like what Matthew Vaughn did with X-Men, for better and for worse.
But, I mean, you're calling him a hack. What does that even mean? But
to see, I mean, it's filming. It's very flat and generic to me. But to see someone with this sense of understanding as to what the medium is capable of, with this ambition and scale, it's marvelous. I was captivated.
Well, Dave, you like this film as well, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I did like this film as well.
I mean, is it for the same intricate reasons that David seems to be enthralled by it? I'm just totally lost.
I mean, there's part of that. Well, I think what I like about the movie is what I sort of liked about the second movie, is you're watching a man who's literally at the top of his game, given as much money to do whatever he wants with a franchise that never had any story because it's based on toys. And so just going off of how cool these things look bashing into each other, I never understood with this trilogy why anybody really expected anything more out of that. So going in with that mindset, I think that this is the most massive special effects extravaganza I've ever seen. That's impeccably executed, and I think it has better 3D than Avatar, because I believe the CG elements and the humans are in the same space, and I sometimes can't tell whether that space is real or falsified. And I think a lot what David was talking about with the interesting angles is an example of Michael Bay working with 3D and kind of it reining him in, and because of that, he allows things to drift in and out of the frame, or allows us to sometimes focus on odd parts of the action because there's going to be something that comes out of the background that, you know, is somewhat important. So I think there's a lot
of
stuff.
I agree with that entirely, that the 3D really enhances the action stuff.
That's really strange, because maybe it's my eyes, maybe it's my brain isn't wired for it, but I just didn't find the 3D to engage me at all. Maybe that one scene where they're jumping out of the planes, but I really, it didn't seem that different than watching it in 2D.
I mean, it's similar to me with, like, Avatar, where I'm going to have to get used to seeing this movie in 2D when I start watching it on flat screens, because I think the depth, especially once we get to Chicago, really helps you figure out what's going on in the action and really helps you with the geography of the action sequences, which I think are actually pretty good. You are free to disagree with that. I guess the other thing I would like to say about Transformers Dark of the Moon is that I'm baffled by the critical response, because I don't know how anybody expected this. I mean, it's undoubtedly better than the second one, and people say that doesn't count, but how could you go into a Transformers movie with your expectation be, I hope it's better than the second one, and not feel like this movie didn't deliver everything it promised to you in its advertising?
Because
its,
I didn't walk into that movie
concepts
like this. Even after, I think Transformers 2 is one of the most disgraceful films I've ever seen, I went into this movie fresh, you know, like, I just want this to be a good movie, and it's still not. That's the thing with me. I don't think I have high expectations as far as, you know, this is a toy line that's being made into a movie, but I do have, I feel like I should be respected as an audience member.
But I don't think that everyone needs to walk away from this film as I did and read it in the ways that I did, but I do feel as if the definition as to what comprises a good movie, how narrow that has become in
now you're talking
film.
Generalizations again.
Well,
what is a good movie? Everyone has their own experience.
Patches, you said in your review that there was nothing that you felt attached to. There's nothing you could attach yourself to.
Yeah.
Which I completely agree. I agree with that point, that it's very hard to find something attached to this movie, and American audiences are going to try to find plot or character, because that's what we are expecting to see.
I think you're wrong, actually.
There's a lot of plot and character presented.
Yeah, there's too much. It's not simple enough.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, when you're saying that I'm being general, but I think that I'm being very specific in saying that if people's primary complaint is that they can't follow the plot and the character, maybe.
But I don't think that
is their definition of what is makes it a bad film. I mean, I would very much agree that the characters are ridiculous and that the plot is incoherent, and yet I thought the film was so successful on so many other levels that I would still very
well. That's why I'm trying to basically differentiate myself from that and say that I'm not worried about the plot and characters, because I know they're going to be terrible off the bat. But there was nothing else beyond that engaged me. The cacophony, as I mentioned, of visual elements, it fell flat. It falls flat in that respect.
A very loud and bombastic comment on the end summation, really, of our blockbuster cinema. I mean, and I think that it's perfectly epitomized by the final scene where we have an hour of chaos and warfare where the city of Chicago is leveled. And the movie ends as abruptly as any film.
Unenjoyable.
I can imagine.
It just, unenjoyable.
A quick voiceover, and then we're out. What I love about that is that it really spoke to me about the. I mean, people are bringing a political element to this film, which I think is, you know, they're free to try that. I think it's no more contrived than any of my readings. But this was maybe the only political element I saw. It says we have all this carnage that we cheer and clap for and are so excited to see, at least I was. And then the moment the dust settles, we're bored, we're done, let's move on. And I thought there was such a telling comment on what we've come to expect from our movies and our conflicts overall. And just the moment things get...
Oh, wow.
Like it doesn't have that sensibility at all.
The moment that...
It does not have that care.
The
There's no that sense that he...
That
was intentional.
Ends, we're out. We're done. And I think that's...
it's a Michael Haneke film.
All right, Dave, you wanted to wrap it up?
I think that I would encourage you, my final thought, I would encourage Matt to watch this like a Michael Haneke film. Why wouldn't you?
I watch every movie like that. I do watch every movie like that.
I think Michael Bay is as much of an auteur.
I would never write Michael Bay off for the chaos that he creates. It's preposterous to think that I would just write him off because there's no story.
No more asinine or... sort of impenetrable than some of the characters in a Michael Haneke film.
Right, but what I'm saying at the end of the day is Michael Bay can't tell a visual story either. He can't let go of his narrative and try and play with the visuals and try and draw us in using just the spectacle. At that, it's hollow in that respect as well.
And while I think that the last hour of Transformers 2 was sort of visual soup, is the term that I used to describe it to in conversation the other day, and that it was too incoherent, this... One, it has snatches of lucidity, and they are piled on top of each other in such a way that it jars you out of it. It's almost like I don't know, Herzogian, it's like Brecht, I should say, in that it draws you in for limited little portions and then pushes you out to a place where you have no idea what's happening and invites you in for moments of clarity and then boots you back out. And that tug and pull between understanding what's happening and being in the movie and being shoved outside the movie, I thought was fascinating and not entirely accidental.
Dave, get us out of here.
Hey guys, I think that this movie is obviously going to divide people on lots of lines, but I think we could all agree that we have a lot we already know about this franchise, and I think the advertising for this movie isn't misrepresenting it at all. So I think everybody who's been listening has a really good opinion and now knows whether or not they're going to go see Transformers 3 Dark of the Moon. Can we all agree on that?
And I would argue, despite Maybe. Having a lot of misgivings about it, I do think it's a movie we're seeing, and actually we're seeing in 3D, which I never expected.
I cannot recommend this film to anyone, unfortunately. At the end of the day, I really wanted to like this film. I wanted it to be kind of like a just fun going along watching the Transformers beat each other up, but it's not enjoyable in that right. I would much rather watch Green Lantern, X-Men, or Thor again, just because they're more enjoyable, and I'm not talking about from a narrative standpoint. I just think the action is more enjoyable.
I would disagree with that categorically. I thought this was the best action I've seen in years. I think that, especially because of how complicated I found it to be, I think that this reveals the superhero movies from earlier this summer to be the child's fair that they are when you're having someone with a unique command of the medium behind the camera. To finish with my thought, I would point everyone towards the Salon Review, and as self-serving as this will appear to be, because I pop up in it, I really and sincerely believe that it is the most eloquent summation of my opinion of the film. Did a far better job in writing than I've done on this podcast, predictably, and I think that this is one of the best films of the year.
I actually
not
feel similarly
quite top
about,
three, as well.
I feel similarly about A.O. Scott's review of Transformers. I think he actually, as he tends to do, has my same opinion on the movie, but says it far, far better than I ever could.
I'm a transformer.
So speaking of our own opinions, we all have them. We've all seen a lot of movies this year. And to move on from the rancor of Transformers 3, we're going to look back at the year in review so far. We're at the halfway mark. And I think we've all seen enough movies this year to kind of pick three that are real standouts for us so far this year. And it was kind of a challenge to everybody. It's kind of hard to remember back that far. Like, remember, like, Sundance? Remember when that happened? That was crazy.
No.
It's crazy. I guess let's use the same order
we had. I remember when Sundance happened for you.
Yeah. Remember, I always think of Leap Year with Amy Adams as being that early January movie that came out like 3 years ago.
No, yeah, it was.
Anyway, let's go the same order we did for the lightning round, which would put Patches up first with his top three.
That makes sense, right? Or should I?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, countdown.
Start with number two and expand
it. So I would say after toiling, and this is very, very off the cuff, everything will change by the end of the year, I hope. But I would say my number three favorite movie of the year is going to be Hannah. An action film by Joe Wright, starring Saoirse Ronan, and something that I just thought was fantastic in its balance between I think it's a straight up action movie, but with a lot of heart and great performances. And I don't know, it was a smaller film, so I'm not sure it made it to everybody's market or whatnot. But I know it divided.
Probably.
It divided a lot of people. I know David hated it and Dave was lukewarm on it, but I think it's phenomenal. I think it's a great little film, and definitely, you know, Joe Wright directed Pride and Prejudice and Atonement, and this was stepping out of his box a little bit. And I got to talk to him at New York Comic Con last year, and he told me he wanted to make a Lynchian, David Lynch-esque action movie, and I think he achieved it full form. I think it's fantastic.
I just watched Mulholland Drive today, and so I've been thinking a lot about Lynch, and I think that he was way off the mark, but I definitely appreciate and respect his effort.
Hannah would be on my top five if we were doing a top five. It would squeeze right in there. I enjoy it.
We may be hearing more about it.
So, Katie, you're next.
Oh.
Spoiler.
Oh, you want me to?
No, you.
I can do all three. I can do all three. Fine, let's do it. Number two on my list is going to be Tree of Life. An outstanding film. I'm still thinking about it. You know, we saw it back in May. We talked about it on the podcast. You can go back and find that review. But it's something I'm still continuing to think about, dwelling on just the imagery. I had the pleasure of seeing my parents this past weekend and trying to convince them to go see it, because it's coming to their little art house theaters very soon. And trying to you know, implore them to go see this movie that doesn't have a narrative in the most conventional sense, but that it's a kind of movie, if you just sit back and let it sweep over you and not really try and think about all the different what's happening in this plot, what does this mean, just soaking it all up, it's a magnificent, magnificent experience. And that's what I loved about it. It is the quintessential visual poem of 2011. Yes, okay, that's true. Well, Green Lantern is too. There. So, but yes, I'm sure this will come up on somebody else's list. I hope.
Green Lantern's
shut your mouth. And my number one, which I'm hoping will make somebody else's list, maybe the person I roomed with at South by Southwest, is Kill List, a movie that has yet to surface. I don't know if it has a distribution plan, and I think IFC Midnight owns it. It will put it out eventually. But when this movie makes it to your area, you must see it. It is by a filmmaker, David, correct me if I'm wrong, Ben Whishaw, I believe is his name. Wheatley? Oh, Ben Wheatley. Ben Whishaw, I think, was in some movies. Ben Wheatley crafted this movie, which is not like his first movie. What's it called? Down Terrace, which is a very funny little British, well, I guess it's not funny, it's terrifying, but a little drama. But Kill List is like nothing terrifying. I could have expected. I saw this movie at 9 a.m. at South by Southwest after like 8 days of watching movies, and it blew my...
And didn't you see
it
later?
Yes, I saw it at 9 a.m.,
and
it's the only movie
again.
I saw at South by Southwest twice, even with all the Attack the Block hoopla.
Do we have any idea?
I hope by the... I mean, before the end of the year, hopefully, but I would expect, if they're smart, to put it around the fall. Because this movie is a horror movie, I think, but in like no other. You know, it's not like Saw. It's not like Scream. This is a psychological horror through and through. It's about, well, I won't even get too far into it, but it starts off as one thing and transforms into so many other things. And every moment is making me gasp and sending my head spinning in circles. I'm sure this is on David's list, so I'll let him do a better job describing it later.
It's a masterpiece
in disguise. So,
all right.
Katie Rich,
maybe hearing about
your top three.
Fortunately for our listeners, IFC Midnight means that the film is also going to be released on video on demand.
Nice.
So regardless of where you live in this country, you should get, if you have cable, you should get a chance to see that.
Katie?
Nice. All right. I'm next, and I have my top three. And my number three is the same as yours, Patches. It's Hannah. That movie has really stuck with me. I saw it twice.
Peanut Gallery.
I thought the score was really amazing. I can't remember who did the score. It's Chemical Brothers.
Chemical Brothers.
It was really amazing. I think the visuals are great. Saoirse Ronan kind of takes her place as this enormous talent. And it's so entertaining. And it's a little like loosey-goosey, and it's got some like big ideas. But I kind of appreciate that about it. It's very ambitious. And I love the hell, but I think, I don't know what the DVD thing is. But if it's not out now, it should be soon. My number two will make David very happy. It was his number one of 2010, A Certified Copy, which Woo! I actually wasn't that crazy. So David, you saw it at a festival last year, and then it had its theatrical release earlier this year. And I wasn't even that crazy about it when I first saw it. It's, now I can't remember the names of the actors. David, who are the actors in this movie?
Juliette Binoche and William Schmel.
Yes, and he's an opera singer who's never been in a movie before. And they basically take a road trip around the small town in Italy and talk, and you don't know what their relationship is. You think they might have been married before. You think they might have just met. You don't really know. And it's kind of got a lot of ideas about art and copies, and as evidenced by the title, but I just really like it as a relationship study. And I've thought about it a lot over the intervening months, which I think is a positive sign.
Out on VOD, David? Is a Certified Copy on VOD?
I think it was on VOD.
It definitely was on VOD. It still probably
right,
is.
Exactly. So people might be able to check it out.
And that's actually a movie that I don't think is a bad movie totally. On VOD.
It's Number two is Kill List. I agree with everything Patches said, and we talked about it. Also talked about this film on an earlier episode of the podcast. I'm glad that Patches and I can hold hands and stroke hair and
let doves fly into the air over Kill List.
I saw it only because I owe Patches a great debt, because I saw him only because he so strongly recommended it me to see it, and I would have hated myself if I had known leaving Austin without seeing this movie. It blew my mind. And
many people in Austin with us did not like this movie. I want to note that for some reason, but they're wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's just bizarre because it seems like such ideal Fantastic Fest sort of fodder, and it was actually under the sort of Fantastic Fest sidebar at South by Southwest. But this is the arrival of a major new filmmaker, and extraordinary. And number one, and I hope a part of me hopes perversely that this isn't my number one at the end of the year, just because it feels so monumental and obvious. But it's The Tree of Life. And
wow, look at us all go. I love this.
Yeah, I mean, it's The Tree of Life. What can I say?
Can't deny it. It's truly great.
It will not be on David Dallas's list. I haven't...
yeah, I need to see it. I gotta see that movie.
I don't know how I've avoided seeing it for a second time. Or if I
we should
just,
go,
so
you and me.
Sort of blown back by
yeah,
it.
Yeah, let's have an outing.
Meet up.
I
won't be there.
Really disappointed in the the boringness and the obviousness of my top three. It gets a little bit more interesting after number three, but maybe at the end of the year we'll spice it up a little bit. But
yeah. And I want to note that I also didn't include anything I saw at Sundance, so there's a lot of interesting stuff in there that will be coming up later in the year.
I cannot deny The Tree of Life.
All right, David. Dave. I don't know why I keep mixing that up tonight. Dave,
yeah. Hey,
your top three.
What's up, guys? So I haven't been having the greatest 2011 in movies, I realized, while looking back at it. I've seen a lot of
Green
independent
Lanterns on your number is on your number one, isn't it?
None of the Sundance movies I saw got actually accepted into Sundance. Like, people would like be like, look at my movie, give me notes. I'm like, oh, man, it's totally going to get into Sundance. None of them got into Sundance.
Sorry, I'm just reading that, Dave, and this is my Skype revenge, and he put in the message that Katie has a snatch of lucidity.
Anyway, so this is, it's not really fair, because my top three, two of them are more design-based than based on their overall movies, and the top one hasn't even come out for all of you yet. So, number three, I have Rango, which is Gore Verbinski's lizard western...
Awesome.
Chinatown.
It's such a good
Echo.
Movie. Congratulations. That was so close to making
that's
my
That's the best description
top three.
You're going to come up with.
Yes, well,
Lizard
it's
Western
good.
Chinatown.
Because yeah, so I really like Rango. It managed to be one of the few original properties that during the spring that made an impression, which was fantastic. My number two is going to be Transformers: Dark of the Moon, which All we right. just reviewed. And you know, if you want to hear why, I have this friend named David Ehrlich who, for about
rewind.
10 minutes, talked nonstop on
Moving
the podcast.
On.
So. Rewind a little bit there, and you'll hear why. And then my number one is Attack the Block, the Joe Cornish alien invasion movie that will be coming to y'all in the end of July, I believe.
That was a strong contender for my list as well, but I was going to wait till it comes out.
David and I both saw that film at South by Southwest, and I think we enjoyed it.
And you're too smart to put it on your list.
It is number 28 on my list.
Same
now.
Here.
Well, I think we've talked a little bit about Attack the Block, but I will say, to do a callback and to bring us full circle, that I continue to tweet at R.L. Stine that he needs to see Attack
You're
the Block.
You're a weirdo.
You guys need to join me.
Now we just know he spends his days Twitter-spamming R.L. Stine. It brings a whole new level.
Not just him. Try to ferret out what other celebrities I'm constantly Twitter-spamming.
Fair enough. Well, I think it's time for dessert. If I don't know about you guys, but...
Yeah. Can I just, I enjoy having those long-winded arguments and then all of us talking about
hug it out, guys. Hug it out.
Yeah.
Okay. Friendship.
So, guys, in honor of Larry
dessert.
Crown,
yeah.
the feel-good
start,
summer
hey,
release.
Dave, let me start again and talk over you. Dessert. Dave, what's our question?
In honor of Larry Crown, the feel-good summer release starring Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts opening this weekend, what's the most egregious example of a good cast in an otherwise uninteresting movie?
Am I first? Yes, I think I am. So I am going to go with @scriptguyphil says Man on Fire, which is a movie that I still have never seen. And I don't know, there's something about it. I like Denzel Washington, but him combined with Tony Scott and that annoying little child, what is her name? Dakota Fanning.
Dakota
no, they're
Fanning.
All wonderful. They're
the
all wonderful,
Fanning.
Actually. But this movie is something I've just never brought myself to see, and I don't think I ever will. I don't know.
Yeah, I like Sean O'Connell's suggestion of Bonfire of the Vanities, because it's both a movie that I've never seen, and it's got Tom Hanks, Bruce Willis, Melanie Griffith, and Kim Cattrall. I also started reading the book at one point and just couldn't stick with it. I think it's more of a late 80s period, you had to be there thing, and I just... Nope, no way, no interest.
David,
I'm going to go with @ChristyPutchko, who said "Lucky Number 11," because that is she says it stars Bruce Willis and Ben Kingsley and Morgan Freeman, and yet is still a totally
it's terrible
adventure. And I would agree with her, and I think that it's one of these. It's one of these Sundance movies. I think it played at Sundance. It's one of these. That,
really?
I don't know. I don't know. But it's one of these indie movies that somehow attracts these ridiculous casts to come in and do like 2 weeks or 2 minutes of work on it. And it just adds up to absolutely
To be fair,
nothing.
The guy who directed Lucky Number 11 also directed the Sherlock BBC series, which is freaking fantastic. So
which
he has totally redeemed himself since this
Speaking
Quentin
of which,
Tarantino
guys, they shot the
I
second
know.
Series of that. So even though they're both in The Hobbit, we're gonna get one.
So, Dave, what is your pick?
Speaking of Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
I'm going to go with...
Just
for my dessert, I'm going to go with Dustin M. Sandoval. We said 30 minutes or left. Less. Because he loves Danny McBride, Nick Swartzen. He has zero interest to see it. And if you guys remember and have been listening to the podcast, that was the thing I suggested we all go see at the end of the summer, even though we didn't have faith in it. So, come on, Dustin.
I want to try and like it.
Oh,
no. I'm confused by the part where he says that he loves Nick Swartzen.
He was funny on Reno 911. I think we can all agree.
Yeah, but I could have been funny on Reno 911. I mean, no points.
As funny
right?
as
yeah,
you
you're
are
so
the
funny
of
on
Louis.
The podcast, David. Dis.
All right. We're gonna leave this week's Operation Kino there, and thanks for listening to a shot about robots. That was fun. We have the sign-off order in front of us. Who are we, everybody?
I guess I'm going first on the sheet here. I'm David Ehrlich. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich and at Criterion Corner. And I found it interesting that I thought I was at my most obnoxious this podcast, but I, for the first time, talked exclusively about things that I loved. I wonder if there's any...
And I am Matt Patches. You can find all my work at mattpatches.com, as well as on Twitter at Mr. M-I-S-T-E-R Patches. And next week, somewhere brand new that I'm going to tell you next week. It's so exciting.
Secrets. Hey, my name is Dave. I spell that D-A-7-E. That is also my handle on Twitter. I will be back at Latina Review soon because Teen Mom Season 3 premieres at 10 p.m. July 5th on MTV, and my life will get a whole bunch easier for a little while.
And I'm Katie Rich. I'm here at Cinema Blend and Kino Katie. I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-U-Y-R-I-C-H, and we'll talk to you next time.
No. Well,
ka-chow!